For the last few weeks, we've been talking about how in the fullness of time, God prepared and called His servant Moses to go and rescue His people Israel from the Egyptians. He had taken them to Egypt for a time of preparation and to turn them into a great nation. And then in the fullness of time, it was time to bring them to the Promised Land. And we've seen the Exodus, we've seen the plagues of getting them out of Egypt, the time that they had in the wilderness to learn to trust in Him, to be His people, to learn His ways, to learn who God is, to learn who they are, to learn what it means to be a people of God. And so for years they wandered in the wilderness. And we see that early on in their Exodus, soon after they left Egypt, well, first they went to Sinai, where God gave them His laws and commands and told them what was expected of His people. And then He took them to the Promised Land and sent spies in and let them take a look at it. But they were not prepared, and they were not ready to trust God enough to take the land. And so God said, okay, well, then you're going to stay out in the wilderness for 40 years until this current generation has passed on. And all men 20 years and older of fighting age who are not willing to fight for me will be gone, and your next generation will be here, and they will be the ones who will go in and take the Promised Land. So they then wander for 40 years. Now, during this time, how would they ever know it's time to go forward into the Promised Land? After years and years of wandering in the wilderness, how do they know it was time to head north and go into the Promised Land again? We turn to Deuteronomy chapter 2. It says, then we turned back and set out toward the desert along the road to the Red Sea, as Yahweh had directed me. For a long time we made our way around the hill country of Seir. Then Yahweh said to me, now this is Moses talking, he's recounting these stories to the Israelites before they go into the Promised Land again. Then Yahweh said to me, you've made your way around this hill country long enough, now turn north. So how did they know when? God told them so. They followed God. God led them in this pillar of cloud by day, fire by night. And that's how they knew where to go. When it was time for them to head north, God told them, and then God led them there. Now, they came around the east side of the Dead Sea, we see, instead of going up in the center as they had before when they had stopped at Kadesh Barnea. On the east side, you've got people who were already there. In fact, in the middle, everywhere you had people who were already there. And the first people they came to coming out of the desert over on the east side of the Dead Sea is the land of Edom, also known as the land of Seir, S-E-I-R. This is where the descendants of Esau, the Edomites, the Esauites, Esau's other name was Edom, where they lived. Now, God did not allow the Israelites to take that land. That was not part of the Promised Land. Why not? Well, we go on in Deuteronomy 2. God says, give the people these orders. You're about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the descendants of Esau, who live in Seir. They'll be afraid of you, but be very careful. Do not provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land, not even enough to put your foot on. I have given Esau the hill country of Seir as his own. So they were not to take that land because God had given that as a gift to the descendants of Esau. Okay, even though the Esauites or the Edomites were not part of the chosen, they were still descendants of Abraham and Isaac, and therefore blessed by God, and this was a gift by God to them, and they were not to attack or provoke or do anything to provoke the Edomites. Okay? So, did Edom give permission to the Israelites to pass through? You know, the Edomites see this huge group of people coming in from the desert, just wanting to pass through. Now, the people are not going to provoke them, but you think of millions of people coming through your land. You don't know anything about them. They're armed. Could they potentially get in the middle of your land and then attack you? How did the Edomites respond? If we turn back to Numbers chapter 20, we see some more details here. We'll start at verse 17. This is Moses talking to the king of Edom. It says, please let us pass through your country. We will not go through any field or vineyard or drink water from any well. or travel along the king's highway and not turn to the right or to the left until we've passed through your territory. But Edom answered, you will not pass through here. If you try, we'll march out and attack you with the sword. But the Israelites replied, we'll go along the main road, and if we or our livestock drink any of your water, we'll pay for it. We only want to pass through on foot, nothing else. Again they answered, you may not pass through. Then Edom came out against them with a large and powerful army. So since Edom refused to let them go through their territory, Israel turned away from them and went around the land of Edom. So the Israelites go around Edom because they cannot pass through Edom. And then the next country they come to is Moab. Okay. Now the boundary line between Edom and Moab is the Zered Valley or Zered Brook. By the time they reach this point here, how much time has passed? We go to Deuteronomy chapter 2, starting at verse 14. It says, 38 years passed from the time that we left Kadesh Barnea. Now Kadesh Barnea is where the spies went in and took a look at the Promised Land. Until we crossed the Zered Valley. By then, that entire generation of fighting men had perished from the camp, as Yahweh had sworn to them. Yahweh's hand was against them until he had completely eliminated them from the camp. So just as God had stated would happen, all of the fighting men, all men 20 years and older, other than Joshua and Caleb, died before they came close to getting into the Promised Land. 38 years had passed since they left Kadesh Barnea. That was right at 40 years since they left Egypt. Okay? So they come to Moab. Moab is a nation of Moabites. Moab is, if you look back in Genesis, was one of the sons of Lot. Lot was a nephew of Abraham. Now, the Israelites were not to take Moab. Why not? Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 9. Then Yahweh said to me, do not harass the Moabites or provoke them to war, for I will not give you any part of their land. I have given Ar, that's the name of that land there, to the descendants of Lot as a possession. Okay? So they weren't able to take Moab, so they go around the east side of Moab as well. Then they reach the Arnon Gorge, the Arnon River. And north of the Arnon River is Amorite territory. Okay, the Amorites were not descendants of Abraham in any way, shape, or form. Now, to the east of the Amorites, though, was the nation of Ammon. Now, the Ammonites, Ammon was another one of Lot's sons. So we see in verse 19 that the Ammonites are also protected by God from the Israelites. We see, when you come to the Ammonites, do not harass them or provoke them to war, for I will not give you possession of any land belonging to the Ammonites. I've given it as a possession to the descendants of Lot. So, these three different peoples, the Edomites, the Moabites, and the Ammonites, all people who are not Israelites, not part of the chosen covenant family, but they are kinfolk, and God had blessed them with this gift of their countries and had with the gift of protection against the Israelites. Okay, so they were not to interfere with any of them. However, north of Moab, west of Ammon, we do not have people who are part of the family. These are the Amorites, and the sins of the Amorites, we saw, had not become full yet in Genesis, but now the time has come for God to punish them and for the land to be given to the Israelites. So, the land will start out east of the Jordan River. Okay, that land east of the Jordan River, how was Israel to capture that, and why? Verse 24, God says, set out now and cross the Arnon Gorge. See, I've given into your hand Sihon the Amorite, king of Heshbon, and his country. Begin to take possession of it and engage him in battle. This very day I will begin to put the terror and fear of you on all the nations under heaven. They will hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you. So how are they going to win? God was going to give it to him. It says, see, I have given into your hand the Amorites. And not only that, but other nations will hear about this and they will be afraid of you. They will hear that you've got God on your side and what God is doing for you and that God's giving you this land and that God has given you victory over these peoples, and other nations will tremble as a result. They fight Sihon, and who especially is responsible for gaining victory over Sihon, the king of Heshbon? Verse 32 and 33. When Sihon and all his army came out to meet us in battle at Jahaz, Yahweh our God delivered him over to us, and we struck him down together with his sons and his whole army. So who was responsible? God was. God gave Sihon, God delivered, it says, Sihon over to Israel at Jahaz. And with that, the Israelites captured the territory from the Arnon Gorge, which is right there, kind of midway, on the east side, midway of the Dead Sea, of the Salt Sea, on up to Jabbok, the Jabbok River, which is on the east side of the Jordan River, kind of almost midway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. So all that territory through this battle at Jahaz became Israelite territory. God gave that to them there. Okay. North of there, you have Bashan is the name of the territory there. And the king of Bashan was a guy named Og. O-G. Okay. Who was responsible for victory over Og? Verse 3. So Yahweh our God also gave into our hands Og, king of Bashan, and all of his army. We struck them down, leaving no survivors. So now, God gave, at Edrei, God gave the northern territory all the, from north of the Jabbok River on up to Mount Hermon, way up north, near Damascus. Okay? So through these two battles, not a whole lot of work on Israel's part, but God gave them victory. God gave them all this territory east of the Jordan River, east of the Dead Sea, east of the Sea of Galilee, all of that area. Now, these victories, were these against just little bitty villages and simple towns and that kind of enemy? Verse 4, at that time we took all of his cities. This is talking about the Bashan cities, the King Og cities. There was not one of the 60 cities that we did not take from him, the whole region of Argob, Og's kingdom in Bashan. All these cities were fortified with high walls and with gates and bars. There were also a great many unwalled cities. So what kind of towns did they conquer here? They conquered big cities, 60 big cities with heavy walls and iron gates and heavily fortified cities, plus a whole lot of little villages. Okay, there were some of those little villages, but the big cities they captured as well. And God gave them these victories as they cleaned this area clear of the inhabitants. Besides the land that God gave them here, how else did God bless the Israelites through these victories? Verse 6 and 7. We completely destroyed them as we had done with Sihon, king of Heshbon, destroying every city, men, women, and children. But all the livestock and the plunder from their cities we carried off for ourselves. So in addition to the land and the victory and the strength that they felt by seeing God's mighty hand at work, they also got wealthy. They received livestock and all the plunder. Coming out of the desert, there wasn't a whole lot of livestock they would have had, but now they would have a lot of livestock from that whole area there. Plus, what happened is what God said would happen in verse 25 of chapter 2. This very day I'll begin to put terror and fear of you on all the nations under heaven. They'll hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you. Okay? So God put fear in the hearts of others and helped prepare them and their enemies for what was about to come. So after these two victories, what territory did Israel claim at this point? Verse 8. So at that time, we took from these two kings of the Amorites the territory east of the Jordan, from the Arnon Gorge as far as Mount Hermon. Okay, so big, big geographical territory that now is part of Israel's territory. Now, who are the neighbors there? Well, way up north, you've got Aram, which is now called Syria. The Arameans are up there. To the east, you have Ammon, to the south you have Moab, to the west you have the land of Canaan, all the Canaanites. So what about some of these neighbors? How did the neighbors to the south, Moab, who they had just passed through, how did they feel about this huge group of Israelites as neighbors? We turn back to Numbers chapter 22, starting at verse 2. Now Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was terrified because there were so many people. Indeed, Moab was filled with dread because of the Israelites. The Moabites said to the elders of Midian, "This horde is going to lick up everything around us as an ox licks up the grass in the field." So Balak, son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at the time, sent messengers to summon Balaam, son of Beor, who was at Pethor near the river, that's near the Euphrates River, in his native land. Balak said, "A people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the land, and they've settled next to me. Now, come and put a curse on these people, because they're too powerful for me. Perhaps then I'll be able to defeat them and drive them out of the country. For I know that those you bless are blessed, and those you curse are cursed." So the Moabites were afraid of the Israelites, this huge group, and gained all this power, and they saw what had happened to the Amorites, those who were ruled by Sihon and Og, and they were afraid for themselves. So the king of Moab sent messengers to Balaam, who was an internationally known prophet at the time, who lived up in Pethor near the Euphrates River. That's up by Haran, up in that area where Abraham had come before he had gone to Canaan, and asked him to come and curse these Israelites, because he knows those you bless will be blessed and those you curse will be cursed. Does that sound a little familiar? Sounds like Genesis 12, the promise that God gave to Abram. May those who bless you be blessed and those who curse you be cursed. Well, we see that already. We see that here in Balak's call to Balaam. Well, how did Balaam respond to this request? Verse 12. "But God said to Balaam, 'Do not go with them. You must not put a curse on those people because they're blessed.' Well, the next morning Balaam got up and said to Balak's princes, 'Go back to your own country, for Yahweh has refused to let me go with you.'" Okay, so he refused him and said, I cannot go. Okay, God won't let me go. Well, what did Balak think about that when the word got back to him that Balaam wouldn't come? Verse 15, "Then Balak sent other princes, more numerous and more distinguished than the first. They came to Balaam and said, 'This is what Balak, son of Zippor, says. Do not let anything keep you from coming to me, because I will reward you handsomely, and I will do whatever you say. Come, put a curse on these people for me.'" Okay? This was an important thing to Balak. He couldn't take no for an answer. He needed God's curses to go on these people and protect him and his neighbors, this invading horde that was coming through. So he said, "I'll pay you well. I'll give you great rewards if you come and do that." So did that promise of money help? Verse 18, "Balaam answered him, 'Even if Balak gave me his palace filled with silver and gold, I could not do anything great or small to go beyond the command of Yahweh my God. Now stay here and I'll find out what else Yahweh will tell me.' So that night God came to Balaam and said, 'Okay, since these men have come to summon you, go with them, but do only what I tell you.'" So Balaam heard this promise for money, and he was interested enough to say, "Well, let me check with God again." God had already told him, "No, do not go with him." But now, you know, there's some good stuff here for me here. God, think about it again. Let me know. And so he asked God again, and God says, "Okay, since they've come back for you, you can go, but you cannot say anything more or less than what I tell you to say." Okay. Well, this whole matter of Balaam asking again, God had made it clear that he didn't want Balaam to go, but yet Balaam asked again, God gave him permission, but you know, Balaam's purpose in this is looking at the money. He sees the great reward that's in store for him. So how does God feel about that? And I'll start at verse 21. Balaam got up in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princess of Moab. But God was very angry when he went, and the angel of Yahweh stood in the road to oppose him. Balaam was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. So you see, even though God had relented and said, okay, you can go with him, just make sure you say what I have to say, he was upset that Balaam didn't take his word the first time, that Balaam came and asked again. So he sends an angel to oppose him. Now, how was Balaam protected from this angel? Because angels are very mighty and powerful. And how did Balaam react to this protection? Going on, verse 23. When the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand, she turned off the road into a field. Balaam beat her to get her back on the road. Then the angel of Yahweh stood in a narrow path between two vineyards, with walls on both sides. When the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh, she pressed close to the wall, crushing Balaam's foot against it. So he beat her again. Then the angel of Yahweh moved on ahead and stood in a narrow place where there was no room to turn, either to the right or to the left. When the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh, she lay down under Balaam and was angry and beat her with his staff. Okay, so the donkey saw the angel, but Balaam didn't. Balaam didn't have the discernment that the donkey had to see the angel. And the donkey tried to stay away from the angel. The donkey protected Balaam from the angel three times, and each time Balaam beat the donkey. Okay, how does the donkey feel about this? Well, we get to find out. Verse 28. Then Yahweh opened the donkey's mouth, and she said to Balaam, "What have I done to you to make you beat me these three times?" Balaam answered the donkey, "You've made a fool of me. If I had a sword in my hand, I would kill you right now." The donkey said to Balaam, "Am I not your own donkey, which you've always ridden to this day? Have I been in the habit of doing this to you?" "No," he said. So an amazing thing. God makes the donkey talk. Okay, the donkey can speak. What's even more amazing to me, though, is that Balaam has a conversation with it. Balaam talks back. Balaam communicates with this donkey. He seems like he's not even thinking about that. So he's really low discernment here on Balaam's part. Okay. How did Balaam finally realize what was happening? Going on. Then Yahweh opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of Yahweh standing in the road with his sword drawn. So he bowed low and fell face down. The angel of Yahweh asked him, "Why have you beaten your donkey these three times? I've come here to oppose you because your path is a reckless one before me. The donkey saw me and turned away from me these three times. If she had not turned away, I would have certainly killed you by now, but I would have spared her." Okay. So Balaam sees the angel, who then tells him how his donkey had saved his life three times. Balaam, it's clear to Balaam now that his choice of asking again and wanting to go see Balak to curse these people is against God's will. So what does he decide to do now? Verse 34, Balaam said to the angel of Yahweh, "I've sinned. I didn't realize you were standing in the road to oppose me. Now, if you're displeased, I'll go back." Okay, so he repents, he confesses, and he says, "I'll go back if that's what you want me to do." The angel of Yahweh said to Balaam, "Go. Go with the men, but speak only what I tell you." So Balaam went with the princes of Balak. So do you think Balaam has on his mind that he's going to say anything different than what God tells him to say? No, the point's been made. So he kept going, but with the warning to say only what God wanted him to say. Balaam goes, he sees Balak. Balak wants him to curse the Israelites. Does Balaam obey? Does he curse the Israelites, or does he obey God and say only what God directs? Chapter 23, starting at verse 5. Yahweh put a message in Balaam's mouth and said, "Go back to Balak and give him this message. So he went back to him and found him standing beside his offering with all the princes of Moab. Then Balaam uttered his oracle. Balak brought me from Aram, the king of Moab, from the eastern mountains. Come, he said, curse Jacob for me. Come, denounce Israel. How can I curse those whom God has not cursed? How can I denounce those whom Yahweh has not denounced? From the rocky peaks I see them, from the heights I view them. I see a people who live apart, who do not consider themselves one of the nations. Who can count the dust of Jacob or number the fourth part of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and may my end be like theirs. So does he curse them? No. He ends up blessing Israel, blessing their numbers, blessing their faithfulness. Okay, so he gives them a blessing. How does Balak respond to that? Verse 11, Balak says to Balaam, what have you done to me? I brought you here to curse my enemies, but you have done nothing but bless them. He answered, must I not speak what Yahweh puts in my mouth? So what does he decide to do? Verse 13, then Balak says to him, come with me to another place where you can see them. You'll only see a part, but not all of them. And from there, curse them for me. So he says, okay, maybe a change in scenery might help. Let me let you see this horde that's bothering me. Let me let you see what we're up against here. Then I want you to curse them. So does Balaam curse the Israelites this time? Verse 14. So he took him to the field of Zophim on the top of Pisgah. And there he built seven altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Balaam said to Balak, stay here beside your offering while I meet with him over there. Then Yahweh met with Balaam and put a message in his mouth and said, go back to Balak and give him this message. So he went to him and found him standing beside his offering with the princes of Moab. Balak asked him, what'd Yahweh say? Then he uttered this oracle. Arise, Balak, and listen. Hear me, son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should change his mind. Does he speak and not act? Does he promise and not fulfill? I received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot change it. No misfortune is seen in Jacob. No misery is observed in Israel. Yahweh, their God, is with them. The shout of their king is among them. God brought them out of Egypt. They have the strength of a wild ox. There's no sorcery against Jacob, no divination against Israel. It will now be said of Jacob and of Israel, see what God has done. The people rise like a lioness. They rouse themselves like a lion that does not rest till he devours his prey and drinks the blood of his victims. So, do we get a curse? No, he blesses them again and says that God's given them this blessing. He's not going to change his mind, no matter what you say or do or where you take me. How does Balak react this time? Then Balak said to bless him, neither curse them at all, nor bless them at all. Don't say anything. Balaam said, well, didn't I tell you that I must do whatever Yahweh says? Then Balak said to Balaam, come, let me take you to one more place. Perhaps it'll please God to let you curse them for me from there. Okay, so he wants to try another change of scenery. What does Balaam say this time? Well, you can read it from verse 29 on through chapter 24. But the last part of verse 9 kind of summarizes it. May those who bless you be blessed, and those who curse you be cursed. Okay? We have more blessings here. And then he concludes it and says, may those who bless you be blessed, and those who curse you be cursed. He repeats God's promise to Abraham back in Genesis 12, verses 2 to 3. That was hundreds of years before. And yet now that still continues to hang over their heads as a great blessing from God. May those who bless you be blessed, and those who curse you be cursed. So he gives another blessing here. All right. Well, after this third blessing, where does Balak want Balaam to go now? Verse 10, then Balak's anger burned against Balaam. He struck his hands together and said to him, I summoned you to curse my enemies, but you have blessed them these three times. Now, leave at once and go home. I said I would reward you handsomely, but Yahweh has kept you from being rewarded. Okay, I promised to give you this great reward, this great gift, this great money if you would come and bless, but you haven't blessed, so I'm not going to give you anything. How did Balaam respond? Starting at verse 12, Balaam answered Balak, "Didn't I tell the messengers you sent me, even if Balak gives me his palace filled with silver and gold, I couldn't do anything of my own accord, good or bad, to go beyond the command of Yahweh, and I must say only what Yahweh says? Now, I'm going back to my people, but come, let me warn you of what this people will do to your people in days to come." Then he uttered his fourth oracle, the oracle of Balaam son of Beor, the oracle of one whose eye sees clearly, the oracle of one who hears the words of God, who has knowledge from the Most High, who sees a vision from the Almighty, who falls prostrate and whose eyes are opened. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star will come out of Jacob. A scepter will rise out of Israel. He will crush the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of all the sons of Sheth. Edom will be conquered. Seir, his enemy, will be conquered, but Israel will go strong. A ruler will come out of Jacob and destroy the survivors of the city. Okay, so what does he say? He's got one more oracle, and this is a double prophecy. This is a prophecy that Israel would conquest the territory and would take charge of Moab and Ammon and Edom, and but also you see the promise of a Savior there, that God would send a Savior through Israel. There we have Moab's attempt to try to get Israel cursed, so, and get rid of the threat of these people that way. But they're not really a threat to them because God has protected Moab. They are not going to attack Moab and take Moab's land. Okay? Now the land of the Canaanite people have more to be concerned about. Okay? But right now, as we see, the Israelites do have some land now. They've got the eastern side of the Jordan River. Now, at this time, a couple of tribes, Reuben and Gad, made a special request. We go to Numbers 32. The Reubenites and Gadites, who had very large herds and flocks, my guess is they took a lot of the herds and flocks from the Amorites that were conquered, saw that the lands of Jazer and Gilead, which are those lands on the east side where they are, were suitable for livestock. So they came to Moses and Eleazar the priest. Eleazar is the son of Aaron, if you remember. And so the leaders of the community and said, "Adaroth, Dibon, Jazer, Nimrah, Heshbon, Eliah, Sebam, Nebo, and Baon, the land that that Yahweh subdued before the people of Israel, are suitable for livestock, and your servants have livestock. If we found favor in your eyes," they said, "let this land be given to your servants as our possession. Do not make us cross over into the Jordan." So Reuben and Gad asked to stay east of the Jordan because the land where they are is perfect for the kind of lifestyle that these people have, for the kind of jobs that they have as far as tending livestock and herds. Okay? How does Moses respond to that? Well, let's zoom to verse 33. You can read the interesting part in the middle. Moses gave to the Gadites, the Reubenites, and half of the tribe of Manasseh got in on this as well. Manasseh was one of the sons of Joseph. He gave them the kingdom of Sihon, king of the Amorites, and the kingdom of Og, king of Bashan, the whole land with its cities and the territory around them. Okay, so he gave them that territory. He granted their request. But there are some stipulations to that in some of those verses that we just skipped, but we also see those in Deuteronomy chapter 3, starting at verse 18. "I commanded you," this is Moses speaking, "I commanded you at that time, Yahweh your God has given you this land to take possession of it, but all of your able-bodied men, armed for battle, must cross over ahead of your brother Israelites. However, your wives, your children, and your livestock," I know you've got a lot of livestock, "must stay in the towns I've given you until Yahweh gives rest to your brothers as he has to you. And they too have taken over the land that Yahweh your God is giving them across the Jordan. After that, each of you may go back to the possession I have given you." Okay? So, he gives them this land with a stipulation that when it's time to cross the Jordan and go in and take the promised land, that all the men of Reuben and Gad and this half-tribe of Manasseh, they go with them. And not only go with them, they go ahead of their brother Israelites. They fight the front lines. Okay? You've already gotten this land, and you have to go fight the front lines, and you have to fight with your brother Israelites until they have all of their land. Okay? And then you can go back You can't, me giving you this land is not giving you permission to back out of all the fighting for God that we're going to be doing. Okay? And they accept that. They understand, and they are not trying to get out of the conquest. They are purely just seeing that land is best suited for them. Okay? All right, now they're now on the east side of the Jordan River, and they've got the land on the east side, and it's getting time to move across to the other side. Before they cross the Jordan River, what command does God give Israel? Turn to Numbers 33, starting at verse 51. Speak to the Israelites and say to them, God tells Moses, when you cross the Jordan into Canaan, drive out all the inhabitants of the land before you. Destroy all their carved images and their cast idols and demolish all of their high places. Okay, high places were up on a hilltop. People would put a shrine there to worship whatever god that they might want to worship there. Take possession of the land and settle in it, for I've given you the land to possess. Distribute the land by lot according to your clans. To a larger group, give a larger inheritance, and a smaller group, a smaller one. Whatever falls to them by lot will be theirs. Distribute it according to your ancestral tribes. Israel's commanded to wipe Canaan clean. Go and destroy all the people. Drive out all the inhabitants. Wipe out all their idols and their shrines to their gods. Don't leave any of that standing. Okay, this is to be a holy land. Okay, and then distribute it among my holy people, Israel. But he gives them a warning. Verse 55. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land, those you allow to remain will become barbs in your eyes and thorns in your sides. Sounds pretty painful. Well, they would be painful. They'd create a lot of problems. We'll see that as we keep going. They will give you trouble in the land where you live. And then I will do to you what I plan to do to them. Okay, so there's a warning that God gives them. Wipe them clean. If you don't, those who remain will be a snare to you, and you'll receive the same kind of punishment that I'm giving them through you. Going on, chapter 34, we see a lot of geography defined, and it's really interesting. If you read through that, you really see some things. Just kind of starting at 34, it says, Yahweh said to Moses, command the Israelites and say to them, when you enter Canaan, the land that will be allotted to you as an inheritance will have these boundaries. And then it goes through and defines all these boundaries. He defines all this land that he's about to give Israel and what all the borders are. And this is before the people have gone in. Okay? Yeah, there were spies earlier, but those spies were 38 years before when they were at Kadesh Barnea. They have not gone in. They don't know all these landmarks, but yet God gives them these landmarks and tells them this is what your territory is going to be. And you know what? As you look at the Israelite history, these are the territory boundaries that they ended up with, just as God tells Moses here before. And Moses never even gets to see the territory. He doesn't know what these names mean. Okay. In addition to that, we have in chapter 35, God says, command the Israelites to give the Israelites towns to live in from within the inheritance that the Israelites will possess, and give them pasture lands around the towns. Then they'll have towns to live in and pasture lands for their cattle, flocks, and all their other livestock. Verse 6 of the towns you give to the Levites will be cities of refuge to which a person who has killed someone may flee. In addition, give them 42 other towns. So 48 towns scattered throughout all of Israel were to be given to the Levites. Okay, the Levites were not going to have their own tribal land. They were the priests. Okay, they wouldn't live the same kind of lives that all the other people would. And so they were to set aside 48 towns, 6 of which would be called cities of refuge, so that if someone accidentally killed somebody, they could go to that city of refuge and basically be exiled in that city, and no one could come and harm them there. So all these are defined and spelled out, and what a city of refuge is described in the rest of there of chapter 35. So you can take a look at that. Okay. So they're ready to go into the promised land on the west side of the Jordan River. Would Moses continue to lead the Israelites to capture this land? Deuteronomy 3, verse 23, and then 25 on. At that time, this is Moses speaking, I pleaded with Yahweh. let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that fine hill country, and Lebanon. But because of you, he's talking to the Israelites, Yahweh was angry with me and would not listen to me. That's enough, Yahweh said. Do not speak to me any more about this matter. Now, he's blaming it on the Israelites, but it was really Moses, right? God wouldn't let him go into the promised land because he had not trusted God when the Israelites grumbled about water instead of speaking to the rock and having water come from the rock to show God's mighty power. Instead, he bangs on the rock and hits the rock with his stick. And you see, Moses is a little upset with the Israelites on here. Now, but God does say, he says, go up to the top of Pisgah and look west and north and south and east. Look at the land with your own eyes, since you're not going to cross this Jordan. Okay, so he's going to let Moses take a look at it and see the promised land from afar. See this great land that's set before them. He won't get to go into it, but he'll get to see it. Okay, but verse 28, commission Joshua and encourage and strengthen him, because he will lead this people across and will cause them to inherit the land that you will see. Okay, so the torch would be passed to Joshua. God chose Joshua as the replacement. Okay, big job. How would you like to be Joshua? These people, look at how these people have turned against Moses, and Moses was one of the greatest prophets of all time. How would you like to follow on his footsteps? Okay, so Joshua obviously had a big task ahead of him. Not just filling Moses' footsteps, but bringing the Israelites into the land and conquering the land and taking the land for God. This is a group of people who turned against God and against Moses and against Joshua and against Aaron every time they had any kind of problems. There's going to be lots of problems in trying to take this territory. So what does God promise to Joshua when faced with this challenging task? We turn to Joshua chapter 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, Yahweh said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses' aide, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now then, you and all these people get ready to cross the Jordan River into the land I'm about to give them, to the Israelites. I will give you every place where you set your foot, just as I've promised Moses. Your territory will extend from the desert to Lebanon, and from the great river, the Euphrates, all the Hittite country, to the great sea on the west. That's the Mediterranean Sea. No one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Joshua, this is a big job ahead of you. I know you're probably nervous about it, but take heart. I am with you. I'm going to bless you just as I've blessed Moses. I'm going to be with you just as I was with Moses. I'm going to make powerful and mighty things happen just with you and through you, just as I did with and through Moses. Okay. So God encourages Joshua. What did Joshua have to do? Well, I'll start at verse 6. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law that my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged. For Yahweh your God will be with you wherever you go. Okay? What did Joshua have to do? He just had to trust God. He had to keep his commands, follow God's commands, know what God's commands are, be strong, lead the people, and then God would be with him. God would bless him. God would give him success. God would take care of everything wherever he went. Okay, as long as he was faithful and followed God. You know, that's a promise and a command that we have as well, that God's given us, is that he will continue to bless us and grant us success in his kingdom as we follow him and remain obedient and faithful to him. So, that was Joshua's part. Well, what about the people? You know, with Moses gone, would the people accept Joshua as their leader? Verse 16, then they answered Joshua, whatever you've commanded us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go. Just as we fully obeyed Moses, you think Joshua thinking, you fully obeyed him? I don't know. But just as we fully obeyed Moses, so we will obey you. Only may Yahweh your God be with you as he was with Moses. Whoever rebels against your word and does not obey your words, whatever you may command them, will be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. So you see, they pledge their support. They pledge, they recognize Joshua to be their new leader, and they promise to obey him and follow him as they did Moses. Okay, that's the most that Joshua could ask for here. So who was Joshua? Where do we first hear about him? Well, we hear about him early on, back in Exodus chapter 17, verses 8 to 9. If you remember, early on, soon after they left Egypt and went out before they got to Sinai, in verse 8, the Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, choose some of our men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. So that's the first time we see Joshua. He leads this army. There's not really an army. This is just a bunch of slaves who have just left Egypt. But yet Joshua has the gift of leadership, the gift of organization, to be able to take those slaves and turn them into an army and go defeat an attacking army of Amalekites. Okay? These were descendants of Amalek, and you see reference to them being giants and very powerful men, and yet the Israelites were able to conquer them through Joshua's leadership, but also really through God giving them this victory. But the Israelites have seen Joshua as a leader from the very beginning there. Now, from that time on, during the wilderness wanderings, what kind of job did Joshua have? What did Joshua do? Because we see him, he remains active. Chapter 24, verse 13. Then Moses set out with Joshua his aide, and Moses went up on the mountain of God. Okay? So Joshua was Moses' aide. He was Moses' right-hand man. You might think of Aaron as being that, but no, Aaron was the priest, and Aaron was his brother. Aaron was his right-hand man there in front of Pharaoh, but in the wilderness wanderings and leading the Israelites, Joshua was. And here we see, even when Moses went up on Mount Sinai, Joshua went with him. In chapter 33, where it talks about the tent of meeting, or the tabernacle, or where Moses would go to meet with God, verse 11, it says, Yahweh would speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks with his friend. Then Moses would return to the camp, but his young aide Joshua, son of Nun, did not leave the tent. So you see, Joshua was there in the tent of meeting with Moses. So being Moses' right-hand man, he was very well prepared for continuing in the faith of Moses, continuing the leadership of Moses, continuing the leadership of this people. His name Joshua, that's not the name that he was born with. Where did he get that name Joshua? Well, if we turn to Numbers chapter 13, this is another time that we see him. In verse 16, it says, these are the names of the men that Moses sent to explore the land. And we see back in verse 8 that Hoshea, son of Nun, from the tribe of Ephraim, was one of the spies that went in. Well, in verse 16, it says, Moses gave Hoshea, son of Nun, the name Joshua. Okay? And that's a meaningful name. Hoshea means salvation. Okay? That's a meaningful name. Well, Joshua means the Lord saves, or Yahweh saves. Joshua in Hebrew means the Lord saved. The Greek form of that is Jesus. Okay, the name Jesus means the same as the name Joshua. Joshua is the Hebrew and Jesus is the Greek. Now, in that story we see where Joshua was one of the spies, we see Joshua's faithfulness early on. Turn to verse chapter 14, starting at verse 6. And really, if you kind of go back, at the end of chapter 13, when the spies come back, you've got verse 27, the spies give Moses this account. We went to the land of which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here's the fruit. But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. We can't take it. It's too powerful. But zoom to verse 6 of chapter 14, and we see that Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had explored the land, they were two out of the 12 spies, tore their clothes and said to the entire Israelite assembly, "The land we passed through and explored is exceedingly good. If Yahweh is pleased with us, He will lead us into that land, a land flowing with milk and honey, and He'll give it to us. Only do not rebel against Yahweh, and do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up. Their protection is gone, but Yahweh is with us. Do not be afraid of them." So he stood up. Joshua and Caleb were the two spies that stood up in opposition to the other 10 spies and said, yeah, it's a great land. Yeah, the people are big and look powerful, but they've got nothing compared to what we've got with God. God's on our side, and if God wants to give us this land, we need to let Him. And did that move the people? Well, the next verse, verse 10, the whole assembly talked about stoning them. Okay, but then the glory of Yahweh appeared at the tent of meetings, all the Israelites, and stopped that. So Joshua and Caleb weren't stoned. But you see his faithfulness in standing up against the other spies who were afraid of the people and trying to convince the Israelites that to trust God. How did God bless Joshua in response to his trust in God to give them the land that he promised with these spies here? Verse 30 of that same chapter. Not one of you will enter the land I swore with uplifted hand to make your home. This is God speaking. And so everyone, 20 years and older, all men will die. The next generation will come in. But he goes on. He says, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun. Those two are the only men over 20 who are going to enter into the promised land. Okay, and why? Because they were faithful. They believed that God would give them victory as God had promised to. Okay, so we see Joshua's faith and Joshua's involvement as a leader from early on. So Joshua is going to lead them across the Jordan River into the Promised Land. How would God make sure that Israel looked to Joshua as their leader as they entered this Promised Land? Go to Joshua chapter 3. Early in the morning, Joshua and all the Israelites set out from Shittim and went to the Jordan, where they camped before crossing over. And there, Yahweh said to Joshua, "Today I will begin to exalt you in the eyes of all Israel, so that they may know that I am with you as I was with Moses." Okay? They've accepted you as a leader, but they haven't seen me work through you yet. You know what? Today, now that we're going to cross the Jordan River, now they will see that. They will know that I am with you, and they will put your trust in you as they had with Moses. Okay? So how did God immediately show Israel that he was with Joshua just as he had been with Moses? Verse 15. I'll start at verse 14. So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest, yet as soon as the priests who carried the Ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan. While the water flowing down to the sea of the Arabah, that is the Salt Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh stood firm on dry ground right in the middle of the Jordan, while all of Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. Okay? So how did God show his hand through Joshua? He parted the Jordan River, just as he had parted the Red Sea with Moses years before. Okay? The people passed on dry ground across the Jordan River just as they had passed on dry ground across the Red Sea. Now this was the next generation. They had heard stories about the Red Sea crossing. They had not seen it themselves. Now they got to see it themselves with the Jordan River crossing, and they see that God is working through Joshua just as he had worked through Moses. Joseph then builds a monument of standing stones where they set up stones on end. If you take a look at them, you say, okay, why are those like that? Stones just don't stand up like that. And that's the reason they would do that, is make people ask why. And why does Joshua do this? Chapter 4, verse 20. And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan River. He said to the Israelites, in the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, what do these stones mean? Well, tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For Yahweh your God dried up the Jordan before you until you crossed over. Yahweh your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of Yahweh is powerful, and so that you might always fear Yahweh your God. Okay? So he set up these standing stones as a memorial to the Israelites and to all people of God's power, and to remind them of what God had done for Israel. So they crossed the Jordan River through this miraculous parted river crossing, and they get to the other side, and then they do some things, they take care of some stuff that they hadn't taken care of for some time. Joshua 5 verse 3. Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the Israelites at Gibeah Haraloth. Now this is why he did so. All those who came out of Egypt, all the men of military age, died in the desert on the way after leaving Egypt. All the people that came out had been circumcised, but all the people born in the desert during the journey from Egypt had not. Okay? So they had not been circumcising the males. These were to be a circumcised, cut-off people. Now that they've come into the Promised Land, they needed that memorial with them at all times. And so they stopped and they circumcised everyone. Okay? Circumcision is a reminder to them to be a set-apart, cut-off people. That's what the word circumcised means, is to separate, to cut off. And they were to be a cut-off people for God. Now then, after that, verse 10, we see, on the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. We haven't seen that they've celebrated the Passover since soon after they left Egypt. When they came to Mount Sinai, they celebrated the Passover. You see in Numbers 9, verses 1 through 5. And now, the time that they crossed the Jordan, they circumcised, and after their healing, then it just happens to be Passover. And they celebrate the Passover, and they begin to celebrate the Passover. Now, how does God show them then through this Passover, through this time, that they really have arrived at the Promised Land, at the promised destination? Verse 11. The day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. The manna stopped the day after they ate this food from the land. There was no longer any manna for the Israelites. But that year, they ate of the produce of Canaan. Okay? All this time, manna had been showing up every day except the Sabbath day. They'd been eating manna over and over all this time, miracle from heaven, even when they were on the east side of the Jordan River. But now that they've come into the heart of the Promised Land, they've crossed the Jordan River, they're ready to take this Promised Land, God stops the manna and shows them, you're here. Your traveling days are finished. You're home. One other way God shows and makes sure that the Israelites know that they're in His Promised Land, verse 13. Now, when Joshua was standing near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and said, are you for us or for our enemies? Neither, he replied, but as commander of the army of Yahweh, I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? The commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy. And Joshua did so. So God sent an angel to Joshua. He met Joshua and said, you're here. This is the Promised Land. Where you're standing, this land is holy. This is the land that God has been promising to you. Okay? This is God's holy Promised Land, ready to give to you. So we start to see then, and we'll talk about them taking this Promised Land next week. But we start to see that already in some of the chapters that we started skipping here. Chapter 2, we see that Joshua secretly sent two spies when they were at Shittim. This is before they crossed over the Jordan River. And he says, go look over the land, and especially Jericho. Jericho was the big, powerful city on the other side of the Jordan River. Heavily fortified, very powerful army. Okay, so they went in, and they went into Jericho and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab, and they stayed there. The king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab, bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. But she took them, and she took them up to the roof, verse 6, and hid them under the stalks of flax that she had laid out on the roof. And then verse 14, our lives for your lives, the men assured her. If you don't tell what we're doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when Yahweh gives us the land. So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house that she lived in was part of the city wall. So these spies went into Jericho, and they were checking things out. They were found out, and so the army or the people went to Rahab's house to get them, but she hid them, and she protected them. And as thanks, they promised, we will take care of you when we come and we take Jericho and we take this land. They give her some stipulations starting in verse 17. Now, you know, this oath will not be binding on us unless when we enter the land, you've got this scarlet cord that you're letting us down through this window. You have that hanging out your window, and then everyone who's in your family needs to be in your house, and we will protect them. If someone's not in their house, in your house, you know, his blood will not be on our head. Okay, it's not our fault. So she says, fine, that's great, that's fine. Now, why did she do this? Why did she protect them? Why did she lay her neck on the line against her own people to protect these spies and not let them get turned over? We see that back in verses 9 to 11. She says, I know that Yahweh has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We've heard how Yahweh dried up the water out of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, who you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, and everyone's courage failed because of you. For Yahweh your God is God, in heaven above and on earth below. So why did she do it? She is afraid, but more importantly, she realized, and the other people were realizing, all these other gods are not gods. There is one God. That is Yahweh. Yahweh is God. He's God of heaven. He's God of earth. Okay? The God of the Israelites is God. And Rahab recognized that. This Canaanite prostitute in Jericho recognized that. And you see this great statement of faith on her part. And, you know, that statement of faith kind of goes further. She plays some important roles. Especially take a look at Matthew 1. Matthew 1, we see in verse 1, is a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And if you look at verses 5 and 6, you see that Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Okay, so Boaz, his parents were Salmon and Rahab. So Rahab married in to the Israelites, married Salmon. Then Boaz became the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Ruth, if you look at the story of Ruth, which we'll look at in a little while, in a couple of weeks, Boaz married Ruth, and they had a son named Obed. Obed was the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of King David. Okay, and if you then keep going through this genealogy, you then get in verse 16 to Jesus. So Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute, was the great-great-grandmother of King David, the greatest king of all of Israel except for one, and that is King Jesus. Okay, and she was a great-great-great-great-many-many-great grandmother of Jesus. So you see her in that family line. Okay. Now, Jericho is the first place that they come in contact to on the west side of the Jordan River. What is God's plan for Jericho? starting Joshua chapter 6, starting at verse 1. Now Jericho was tightly shut up because of the Israelites. No one went out and no one came in. Then Yahweh said to Joshua, "See, I've delivered Jericho into your hands, along with its king and its fighting men." Okay, in other words, it's already done. You haven't seen it yet, but it's already done. So what you need to do is march around the city once with all the armed men. Now do this for 6 days. Have 7 priests carry trumpets of ram horns in front of the ark. On the 7th day, march around the city 7 times with the priests blowing their trumpets during that time. When you hear them shout a long blast on the trumpets, have all the people give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the people will go up, every man straight in. Okay? How do you get over these fortified walls, huge walls of Jericho? And in fact, those walls have been found by archaeologists. Well, God's plan was they would march around the city 6 days, and then again on the 7th day, but this time they would march around 7 times. They'd blow a loud blast of the trumpet, and people would shout, and the walls would collapse. Okay? These walls were many feet thick. There's no way they would just collapse on sound noises, but there's a way under heaven. God would make it happen. So how successful was God's plan? Verse 15. On the 7th day, they got up at daybreak and marched around the city 7 times in the same manner, except that on that day, they circled the city 7 times. The 7th time around, when the priest sounded the trumpet blast, Joshua commanded the people, "Shout, for Yahweh has given you the city. The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to Yahweh. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies that we sent." Okay. And then verse 20, when the trumpet sounded, the people shouted, and at the sound of the trumpet, when the people gave the loud shout, the wall collapsed. So every man charged straight in, and they took the city. They devoted the city to Yahweh and destroyed with a sword every living thing in it. Okay, a big sacrifice of the city. And even not they killed the men and the women, the young and the old, but also the cattle, sheep, and donkeys. Those are valuable. They could have just taken those, but instead, they offered the whole city as a sacrifice to God. And then verse 25, "But Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute with her family and all who belonged to her, because she hid the men Joshua had sent as spies to Jericho. And she lives among the Israelites to this day." So she was still around when this book was written. Okay. Now Hebrews 11, the great chapter on faith, tells us that the reason this happened, the reason that this victory happened this way, was because of faith. Hebrews 11, verse 30 and 31, "By faith, the walls of Jericho fell." Okay, there's no physical way, no way on earth that those walls should have fallen, but the people believed. They had faith. They trusted God that God would make the walls fall, and as a result, they did. After the people had marched around them for 7 days. "By faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient." Okay, so you see, faith brings them this victory. Now, the city of Jericho is destroyed. Joshua puts a curse on it. At that time, verse 26, Joshua pronounced this solemn oath, "Cursed before Yahweh is the man who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn sons will he lay his foundations. At the cost of his youngest will he set up its gates." Okay, so Joshua put a curse and said, if anyone dares rebuild this horrible city, rebuild this city that we have sacrificed and given to the Lord, then that person will do so at the cost of his firstborn son, okay, when he lays the foundations, and when he finishes it and puts the gates in, he'll lose his youngest son. And we see that happen. 1 Kings chapter 16, verse 34, we see that in Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid its foundations at the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram, and he set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub, in accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, the son of Nun. Okay, just as Joshua had given that curse then happened. How did God use this victory of Jericho to further support the leadership of Joshua? Final verse of chapter 6. "So Yahweh was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land." Not only did it build Joshua up in the eyes of the Israelites, and they recognized that God worked through Joshua, but it also built Joshua up in the eyes of the enemies, the people in the land, the people that he was going to be
fighting.
And dread in their hearts happened as a result. Let's pray. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you give us in your word. They show us your great mighty power at hand. They show us your love for us, that you're there to guide us and protect us and to bring us closer to you. They show us that you have a plan and that nothing that anyone can do will get in the way of that plan and get in the way of the success of that plan. We thank you for making us part of that plan, for calling us as your people. We thank you for the forgiveness that you give us when we fall short of the requirements, the guidelines, the expectations that you have of us as your people. Continue to send your Spirit among us, work through our lives so that we may do your work despite our sinfulness. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.